Second case of the day, the United States versus Roepke. Mr. Howard.
May it please the court. My name is Eugene Howard. I'm here on behalf of the appellant Daniel Roepke. Just by way of a bit of factual background, in the district court, two cases involving Mr. Roepke were consolidated for purposes of sentencing. Generically, one is a felon in possession case, the other is a fraud case. This appeal only involves the felon in possession case. Mr. Roepke did not appeal the gun case. Now, in the briefs submitted to the court, Mr. Roepke has raised five issues. Although not waiving any of the points in the appeal, I'd like to focus this morning on the fifth issue raised in Mr. Roepke's appeal, namely the impact of Booker, United States versus Booker, on his case. With respect to that issue, Mr. Roepke respectfully submits that under Booker, he is entitled to have his sentence vacated and have the case remanded for sentencing. Now, he concedes he did not raise a Booker Sixth Amendment challenge at the time he was sentenced, and that, therefore, this court's review will be under the plain error doctrine. Under that doctrine, Mr. Roepke must show that the court committed an error, that it was plain, that it affected his substantial rights. In Booker, as this court's well aware, the court determined that the defendant's Sixth Amendment rights are violated when the district court, acting under mandatory guidelines, imposes a sentence that is in excess of that which is authorized under the facts found by the jury verdict alone or admitted by the defendant. In this particular case, the district court below made certain factual findings. First of all, the court found that some 31 to 33 weapons which Mr. Roepke handled while he was an employee at a pawn shop in St. Louis were part of the relevant conduct as far as the counts of conviction. He also determined that Mr. Roepke obstructed justice by testifying falsely at trial. The judge made those findings under the mandatory guideline system based on a preponderance of the evidence based on reliable evidence. It was not found by a jury verdict beyond a reasonable doubt.
Counsel, I gather if the district judge were to have this case back, he would have treated the fact that he worked in a pawn shop and handling weapons different than he did under the guidelines?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not so sure that he would under the advisory system now, but back our contention on appeal is basically that's a fact-based issue which the judge determined on a preponderance, didn't make that determination beyond a reasonable doubt that they were actually involved in the offense and conviction. They were part of an ongoing series of offenses.
So you're saying he couldn't consider it at all because the jury did not make a determination?
Well, I think that under the mandatory system, the result of that was he applied a six-level enhancement to Mr. Roepke's sentence, which substantially increased the sentence he was facing on the felon in possession counts.
But if he had to review it again, you're saying the jury didn't make that determination, and therefore he can't.
Well, no, I'm not saying that because at this particular point, the Supreme Court, under Booker and Fantan, has indicated that the guidelines are advisory. That was not the case when Mr. Roepke was sentenced. They were mandatory. I think that it's possible that the court would make the same determination but wouldn't necessarily have to impose the same sentence. And because it's advisory and because different arguments might very well be made by the defense counsel at focusing on the factors under 3553A, that a different sentence might possibly be imposed by the court. Essentially, we think.
Well, how would you frame this argument? Is that he just had a job and there was no criminal activity involved? He was just handling the guns as part of his job?
Well, yes, sir. I mean, that would be part of the argument that I would frame. First of all, that it was connected at all to the offense of conviction. The offense of conviction were basically Mr. Roepke obtained three hunting type rifles, gave to his girlfriend's son to use hunting with his father. I'm not so sure that the weapons there had any connection with that whatsoever. But even if the court would make that determination, the defense counsel at sentencing could focus more on the factors in 3553 and make another argument, make the argument that for example, a sentence at X range other than what the court has imposed is sufficient to satisfy these objectives. I think the defense counsel could also spend more time investigating Mr. Repke's complete background, all of his characteristics, and weight his sentencing presentation more along that basis. When he was sentenced, the guidelines were in effect. And essentially, they eclipsed and tied the defense counsel's hands, because a lot of those type of arguments would not only be irrelevant under the mandatory guideline system, the court simply couldn't consider those. Really, the only thing about the personal characteristics they could really consider was the criminal history. So essentially what our argument here is that the district court's findings were plain error, and they affected Mr. Repke's substantial rights because it substantially increased his sentence. And even if the court did make the determination about the weapons, Your Honor, that they were connected, there still was a determination about the obstruction of justice. And again, we're talking about a different offense level of somewhere between 19 and 36 months that Mr. Repke is facing now, as opposed to what the guidelines would be under the facts that are found solely by a jury beyond a reasonable doubt, as opposed to those found by the court based on a preponderance of the evidence. So
he got 87 months. What was the guideline range?
Well, the guideline range was as found by the court was 70 to 87 months. Well,
so
however,
he
what
got
that
87
was
87 months. Does that mean that the judge was constrained at all because it was a mandatory system? And the judge might have wanted to give him more.
Well, I guess that's a possibility, Your Honor. But
that's a possibility if you go back on a remand, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is a possibility that the court, if it was remanded, that the case would no longer be grouped, and the court would then be able to increase the sentence or make it more of a consecutive sentence. Mr. Repke's aware of that and still want to proceed forward.
That's the problem with these sentences that are at the top of a established guideline range, that the judge might, on reconsideration, say, I was...
Well,
they were mandatory, but they were mandatory in restraining me from imposing the kind of sentence I think is appropriate, and it would be more.
Yes, Your Honor. On the other hand, when Mr. Repke was sentenced, it was mandatory system, and a lot of the factors in 3553 were not addressed at all by counsel at the sentencing. And as previous counsel in a prior case mentioned, I'm not so sure we know what the judge might do, and I don't. I think whether or not that sentence would end up being reasonable, you have to look at not only the sentence that was actually imposed, but the system under which it was imposed. And in fact, previously, it was under a mandatory guideline system, and under Booker Fanfan, I submit that the court's determinations and his factual findings violated my client's Sixth Amendment rights to a jury trial.
Your argument is that you actually couldn't argue before the district judge that 3553 factors should
well be. To the extent that they were prohibited by the guidelines, yes, that is my argument, that I believe it's really possible that the defense counsel would have focused more on that than focusing merely on the objections and the guidelines, because the arguments under 3553A would in most part they conflicted with the guidelines, and they would have made that whole presentation irrelevant. That's essentially the argument that I have based upon the Booker issue. For those reasons, Mr. Repke would ask the court to vacate the sentence and remand it for resentencing in accordance with Booker. Again, to point out, although not waiving the other points that have been raised in the briefs, I believe they've been adequately addressed and would like to submit those on the record. Thank
All
you,
right.
Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Howard. Mr. Clark.
Good morning, Your Honors. First of all, with respect to these enhancements that my opponent raises, I'm not so sure that Booker really applies to them, because, in fact, during his testimony at trial, Mr. Booker actually admitted to possessing those 33 firearms. That would have been in cross-examination. Secondly, with respect to the enhancement for obstruction, I think implicit in the jury's finding is the fact that he lied on the stand in regard to these firearms. Furthermore, Mr. Howard has suggested the sporting exception and acceptance of responsibility as Booker issues, but they're not, because those, in fact, are reductions rather than enhancements. So Booker simply doesn't apply to them.
Let me ask you, counsel, if Mr. Repke, is that his name?
Yes, sir.
Had worked at Walmart.
Yes, sir.
In the sporting goods section, and was called upon to sell shotguns and or rifles. So that would be a violation of the statute?
Well, assuming that he handled them, yes, Your Honor, it would be. There would be no difference between what he was doing and the hypothetical you're suggesting. I suppose it would be a closer call if he merely handled some paperwork at Walmart, but that's not what happened in this case. He was actually handling the firearms, although I would not concede that point entirely, because I think even under our constructive possession rules, even handling the paperwork might be construed as a type of possession. But that's not really what we have.
Do you think that the district judge might look at that sort of handling and possession of firearms differently than if he had purchased them and had them in his house?
Even in terms of imposing sentence? I don't think so, Your Honor, in this particular case. It might very well be true in a separate case, but in this case, I think Judge Evans' question before regarding sentence at the high end of the guidelines, I think we have a clear indication from this judge that he would not sentence any differently down below, or at least certainly wouldn't sentence.
Judge Evans has a reputation of high sentences. So.
I see. Well, there was one other factor, though, in the sentencing determination that would suggest that he would not go down below that, and that is that the defendant sought an enhancement sought a departure downward based on an otherwise unlawful handling of the weapon. The judge denied that. He had the opportunity to grant that if he wished, but he in fact denied that. So I think there's every indication here, particularly with the comments that the judge made about the type of person that this defendant was, that he's not going to go down below. But there's another thing that I think is very important here to understand about the plain error analysis when considering whether the sentence would be different on remand, and that is Booker asks you folks to look at the 3553 factors in addition to the guidelines. And what is absent from the defendant's argument, both in his briefs and orally, is if, in fact, the judge were to consider these 3553 factors, what specifically about those factors would change the sentence down below if it went back on remand? He has not pointed to anything in here. He's had the opportunity. He lists the 3553 factors, but he doesn't argue that there are any specific 3553 factors that would affect this guy's sentence if the court were to remand for sentencing.
And that's not present in this case, but what is your view of the not ordinarily relevant portions of the guidelines, which tell sentencing judges that you're not supposed to consider someone's age, their prior good works, their employment record, their mental condition, their physical condition, all those sorts of things are sort of off base. What has Booker done to that?
Well, I think clearly Booker would tell us, if this were a new sentence, that the judge is entitled to consider those things. He must look at the guidelines first, realize that the guidelines say that they aren't normally applicable, but then he must also analyze the entire case with regard to the other factors in 3553. But what we're dealing here with is a plain error review, and it seems to me that, as prior counsel in the last argument indicated, that it is the defendant's burden to show that there would be a difference in the sentence, that his rights were actually likely to have been affected. The Rodriguez case from the 11th Circuit suggests exactly that, that instead of just remanding all these cases, that we examine each one individually and determine whether or not the defendant has established his burden of showing, making some kind of showing, that that his sentence would actually have been affected. And if the balance isn't tipped in that way, if it only is on the balance and not tipped in his favor, then he loses. I think that's the right approach to take in these cases. I think that
you don't buy the Fourth Circuit's approach.
No, sir, I don't. I think that the 11th Circuit in that Rodriguez case rejected the Fourth Circuit approach. Now, I do understand from having heard a few other arguments this week that some judges may be considering, in the circuit, may be considering some type of limited remand. That, of course, would not be my first choice, but if that's the choice that the court were to take, then I think that the appropriate action would be to not just simply ask the district judge whether the sentence would have been different had the guidelines been advisory, but not only whether, but why. I think that that would be important for this court to determine whether or not the plain error standard has been satisfied. I don't think it's enough to just ask whether the district court would have been different, I mean, whether the district court's decision would have been different, but why? Because if the reason given by the district court judge is inadequate, then I don't think that the plain error standards have been followed. Again, that would not be my first choice in this case because I think it's clear that he would not have gone lower. I think that the sentence at the high end and his comments and the fact that he did not grant that departure clearly indicate that he would not go lower. I might also point out, Judge Evans, you asked the defense counsel, appellant's counsel, if he might even go higher. Well, one thing that I don't think that the appellant has raised is the fact that if this does become unbundled when it goes back down, it seems to me that now the court could increase criminal history by a full category level because he would be counting the sentence that has already been imposed for the fraud case.
It sounds to me, however, as your opponent has described that to his client, and his client said, roll the dice.
Well, just wanted to make sure that he understood that, Your Honor.
I think he does. Yeah, in 3553A1 talks about the history and characteristics of the defendant, which is absolutely contrary to what the guidelines currently provide. I mean, is the judge now able to take that into consideration?
I think he's able to take that into consideration, yes. But in this particular case, Your Honor, he did look at those past characteristics. He pointed out that the defendant had gone to one of the service academies, had been in the Marines, and had, up until his first conviction, had led a relatively exemplary life. And so he was shocked that this defendant would commit not only the first fraud that he committed, but also the gun and fraud actions that he did. And so I think that the judge, in the back of his mind, has said to himself that in this particular case, you know, here's a guy who had the world by the tail, basically, and rejected that in favor of pursuing a livelihood, a criminal livelihood. So I don't think that on remand that that factor would be much of an issue. I think that that's clear in the record. With that in mind, Your Honor, I would simply ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Mr. Howard.
Yes, Your Honor. Just briefly, in rebuttal, I would submit on behalf of Mr. Repke that we would urge the court to follow the Fourth Circuit's reasoning in terms of remand in these cases rather than the 11th Circuit cases. That's briefly what I have in rebuttal. Thank you.
All right. Our thanks to both counsel, and the case is taken under advisement.